What's up, everyone? Welcome back to another fun-filled episode of the Between the Tackles podcast. I'm Burge. I'm here with Manish tonight. We have a very special episode here. Manish, you want to tell us what we're going to be getting into tonight?
Yeah, we're really grateful to welcome a longtime NFL reporter, Sports Illustrated for almost 30 years, New York Newsday, and then going way back, Cincinnati Inquirer, and then finishing up at NBC Sports. Honestly, the best NFL reporter of my lifetime, somebody that I grew up admiring and I'm really thankful to call a friend, and that's Peter King. Peter, in air quotes, is retired, but is still working with Jim Gray on the Let's Go podcast. You can find that wherever you listen to podcasts. Peter also has a forthcoming book, I believe his sixth book, which we'll get into a bit later, and a really fun piece on NBC Sports on Super Bowl Sunday in the pregame, which we'll also talk about. But first and foremost, Peter, welcome. Thank you very much for coming on.
My pleasure, guys. Happy to be with you tonight.
Obviously, you know, the jumping off point is the hot button topic of the week, and that was the surprising news in a report by ESPN, Seth Wickersham and Don Van Natta, that Bill Belichick did not get in his first year of eligibility into the Pro Football Hall of Fame. Belichick, of course, widely recognized as the best coach of the Super Bowl era. So, Peter, you had been a voter for more than 30 years, did not cast a ballot this year, but I want to get your thoughts on Belichick not getting the requisite votes to be inducted into Canton this year.
Yeah, when I retired, Manish, in 2024, I also left the Hall of Fame committee. So I've been replaced. I haven't voted the last 2 years. So it's over for me. It was time for new voices to be heard, I thought. So obviously I was surprised. I think everybody is surprised that Belichick did not get in. I think it is a mistake, but I've always sort of felt on the committee that my vote counts the same. You know, when I left, I was one of 50. For a while, I was one of 48. Then I was one of 40 or one of 36 or whatever. You know, it's varied a lot over the years. And when I first got into it, I think there were 34 voters back in 1992, if that many. But be that as it may, I don't know. I wasn't in the room. Obviously, you hear a lot on social media about what might have happened, what did happen. But whatever the rationale, I don't really understand it, because I firmly feel it's like for years when Paul Tagliabue struggled to get in, before he got in, I always would just sort of think, yes, Paul Tagliabue was late to the party, quite late to the party on taking head trauma seriously, or as seriously as he should. But the fact is, eventually he did. And you got to be judged on your entire resume. You got to be judged on everything, not just one thing. And look, it's a proven fact that Bill Belichick violated the bylaws of the NFL during the Spygate thing by having somebody, you know, from the Patriots organization taping the Jets sidelines on opening day 2007 after he had been warned not to do it. And he still did it. So he deserves his punishment for that thing. But I certainly don't think that it rises to the level of keeping a guy out of the Hall of Fame. But again, I'm not involved in it, so I don't know much more than people reading social media know about it.
It's funny because after the initial shock among the NFL's fan base that he did not get in, the NFL, the Pro Football Hall of Fame, I should say, did release a statement essentially saying that voters could face ramifications if they don't adhere to the bylaws moving forward. A nebulous statement, not really sure how much teeth that has, but they did respond to the response that the fan base had, being so surprised that Belichick didn't get in. What's fascinating to me is that Vahe Gregorian of the Kansas City Star, who has been a voter, I believe, since 2021, actually wrote a piece explaining why he did not vote for Bill Belichick. And as he explained it, it was not anything related to Spygate or maybe his relationship with reporters, but more so votes for the three senior candidates, LC Greenwood, Kenny Anderson, who you know really well from covering him back in the day, Peter, and Roger Craig. And Gregorian, as he explained it, felt that those three guys were essentially down to their last opportunity to get into Canton. So he decided to vote for those three instead of not only Bill Belichick, but Robert Kraft, who's up as a finalist, as a contributor as well, thinking that Kraft and Belichick obviously will get in at some point where these three candidates, former senior, former players, would not have an opportunity beyond this year. So, what's your reaction to that rationale from one voter?
Well, I understand it. I, in fact, use similar rationale, which I came to regret. I forget what year it was, but the year that Troy Polamalu got in. If I can just sort of explain this, voting for the Hall of Fame is very often a numbers game. And I think it's a numbers game with the way that the seniors and the coaches and the contributors work, because now they lump all three categories together and you can vote for a maximum of three out of the five who are advanced to the finals every year. So Vahe, obviously, in what he wrote in saying he wanted to vote for the players because this was in all likelihood their last year, I understand it, but I did the same thing in 2020. I did not vote for Troy Polamalu for the Hall of Fame because my theory was that Troy Polamalu is going to get into the Hall of Fame easily. And he did get into the Hall of Fame that year. And my belief is that there were other people who I thought were really on a razor's edge that year, including Tony Boselli, who I was a big advocate of. And so I said, look, me not voting for Troy Polamalu is not going to hurt him. And it didn't hurt him. He made the Hall and all that. But I realized after I did that, that I had made a mistake. Because I think if you are on the Hall of Fame committee, you have to abide by the bylaws of the Hall of Fame. And the bylaws say that you have to vote for who you think is most deserving. They don't say that, okay, if you think a guy is most deserving, but you're sure he's going to get in, it's okay to not vote for him if you want to vote for other people. And so, I'm sure that that had a lot to do with why Belichick didn't get in. Yeah. Whether other people felt that way, at least one person did. And I guess the point is that I think it's wrong. I don't just think it's wrong. I know it's wrong. I was wrong in 2020 when I didn't vote for Polamalu because I knew he was going to get in and I wanted to vote for somebody else. I'm sure that Vahe and others, if anybody else did this, were sure he was going to get in. And what harm can my vote do if I vote for somebody else? Well, when I voted for somebody else in 2020, it didn't hurt Polamalu because he made it. But obviously, unless Vahe believes that Ken Anderson is more deserving for the Hall of Fame than Bill Belichick, which would be shocking to me that somebody would think that, what you're doing is you're taking law into your own hands. And again, I like Vahe, I really do, but it's not what our charge is. Our charge is to vote for the people we think are the most deserving.
Yeah, it's I mean, I can't believe we're having this conversation. The notion that Bill Belichick wouldn't get in his first opportunity, but you know, everyone has a different motivation for their votes. No, so Bill Belichick, you know, as we all know, I think he's linked forever to two quarterbacks. One, of course, is Tom Brady. The other is Eli Manning, who beat Bill Belichick's teams twice in the Super Bowl. And according to Ian O'Connor of The Athletic, Eli Manning also did not get in this year. And this was Eli's second year. Eli, you know, being in New York for a long time, has been such a polarizing figure, even when he was playing. And you're fully aware of that, Peter. But the two Super Bowl MVPs should, I think, count enough for him to get into Canton. But now, for his second consecutive year, he's going to have to wait. What are your thoughts on Eli not getting the requisite votes either this season?
Well, I kind of always knew that it was going to be difficult for Eli, even though I believe he should be in the Hall of Fame. You know, and let me get to that first. I believe that when you perform at the absolute top of the game in the two biggest games of your life, when you evade a sack and you throw a pass that David Tyree catches as some miracle in the
killing
first
me
game
over here.
And then you in the second, and you go on to beat the great Brady and Belichick. And then 4 years later, you make a pass to Mario Manningham. And I remember talking to Eli about 4 or 5 days after the game for my week after the game column. And I said, how does it feel to know that on the biggest pass of your life, you made the best pass of your life? And, you know, Eli, and I don't mean this in a negative way. Eli never says anything. He's not, no, he's just a aw shucks guy, you know? And so, you know, he didn't say anything particularly profound, but Eli Manning made the biggest pass of his life on the biggest play of his life, I think. And that pass to Manningham up the left sideline that sort of put them in position to beat the Patriots. The point is, I think Eli Manning belongs, but whatever. The reason it's going to be difficult is that he had a lot of mediocre years. There's no doubt about it. And he only won I think I'm right in saying this, guys. I think he only won playoff games in 2 years, a playoff game or more in 2 years out of however long he played, 16. I don't even know. But he only won playoff games in 2 seasons out of his whole career. He's a 500 quarterback in the NFL, never first team all pro. So look, bottom line is, I know it's going to be difficult. I would vote for Eli because I believe that the meaning of those two games, you know, overrides a lot of the mediocrity that he had in his career.
And just describing those games, I mean, as a lifelong Patriots fan, oh, I was reliving it there.
But, you know, hey, you've got to admit, come on. I mean, you've totally lived a charmed life.
Oh,
and
yeah.
You're back in the Super – hey, listen, you're back in the Super Bowl, and the vast majority of the team 2 years ago, you never heard of any of these guys. So, I mean, this is – you know, this Super Bowl, this reminds me so much of 2001, you know. This reminds me of, you know, the underdog Patriots, the total nobodies coming out, being introduced as a team, not as individuals. That's still, people are surprised to think they won that game, but it just shows you in football, that on any given day, a really smart game plan with a great coaching staff can beat anybody in football.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's funny you bring that up. I mean, I'm a spoiled Patriots fan. I would be the first one to admit it. I mean, I kind of grew up with this. You know, I was, some of my earliest memories of watching football with my family were during those early runs. And one of the guys is a finalist this year from that early run, and that's Adam Vinatieri. My opinion, the best clutch kicker ever to, you know, kick in the game in the NFL there. You know, I want to speak about him, his chances about getting in, and then, you know, to kind of piggyback off that, why have we not seen more members of that, specifically the early dynasty of the Patriots in Canton? We know that Richard Seymour's there, Ty Law's there, Randy Moss is there, and there's nobody else, like guys like Logan Mankins, Vince Wilfork, Rodney Harrison haven't been able to get into the hall. So I just wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Well, I think Adam Vinatieri is going to go in. So, you know, there's one more. Look, the Patriots, I wrote a chapter on them in this book I'm working on right now. And it's, I mean, it, the Patriots, the early great Patriots teams, they basically, year after year after year, they had so many rental players. And they had so many guys who they would fit in under the cap. And look, in 2001, in that Super Bowl, I would maintain that that Otis Smith, who made, I think, $440,000 that year, that Otis Smith, if you know, you could argue that he should be in the discussion for the MVP of that game. You know, he and Ty Law just were fantastic in that game. But again, my only point of this is Corey Dillon came in for a cup of coffee, and, you know, Antoine Smith, and, you know, even Mike Vrabel was there for a little bit longer than that. But I think the problem with a lot of the arguments to make to get people in the Hall of Fame is that a lot of those guys just weren't there for very long. And so it's not like, and you're right. I mean, Logan Mankins was, you know, he was there for a long time. But I think that this was not a team that, like, for instance, Bill Belichick, Scott Pioli took over in 2000. And, you know, before you could blink an eye, they'd won three Super Bowls in 5 or 6 years. So it wasn't like all of the guys who they drafted became the cornerstone players. That team right away had to go mining for talent in low-cost free agency. You know, a guy like Mike Compton, who became a great guard for them. You know, they basically gave him a take it or leave it offer for, I don't know, $800,000 or $900,000. And they did that with a lot of guys. They did it with Vrabel, I think, the second year. So anyway, I don't know if that answers your question, but I think they had a lot of guys who weren't altogether thought of as, you know, 10-year players who made the Pro Bowl 7 times or first team All-Pro 5 times. So they just didn't have that kind of team. It wasn't the kind of team that they built.
I sit here and I think, like, obviously I'm a fan. When I think about Hall of Fame type players, I think of the best players at their position for their era. And that for me would be what would determine whether I would think that they should be in the Hall of Fame or not. And I look at, like, specifically like Logan Mankins, a guy who was there for a while, and then Vince Wilfork, who I considered probably
Vince
one of the
Wilfork
better.
Vince Wilfork has a good case. You're right about that. You're absolutely right about that. But, and so I'm not trying to say that they don't have anybody else. Because I don't believe that that's the case, but I do think that a lot of times, and Logan Mankins was there, whatever, 8 or 9 years. And he, you know, he was a consistent Pro Bowler. And I'm not here to argue you out of your thought. I'm just saying that, let's just say you put Logan Mankins up against Will Shields, or I don't even know who would be, you know, a good comp for him. But I guess what I'm saying is, you know, if you put him up against, let's say, Jari Evans or Marshall Yanda, I mean, there's some pretty good competition in those days. And like, there's a good chance that the two guys I just named, Jerry Evans and Marshall Yanda, might be the two best guards of the first 15 years of this century. And they haven't gotten close. Who knows? Maybe they got close this year. I don't know. But there's some good competition. So anyway, that's kind of what I think.
Oh, you answered my question.
Are you surprised, Peter, that I know the contributor category is, you know, there are no hard and fast rules, but are you surprised that Robert Kraft, operating under the assumption that he does get in this season, has waited this long to get in?
I don't think you should operate under that assumption. I have no idea, but everybody always thinks, well, he's going to get in this year. Come on, he's got to get in. But listen, and again, I'm not in there, so I don't know. And even when I was in there, I didn't walk around and say, why aren't you voting for Kraft? I don't even know if they are voting for Kraft. It's a private right. vote. But I think the one thing, this Kraft thing bothers me a little bit, because someone who has taken, who has been the owner for, I would say, four distinct teams with three different coaches, two of whom he hired. When he hired Bill Belichick, Art Modell said, if you hire Bill Belichick, it'll be the worst mistake you'll ever make. When he hired, when he hired Mike Vrabel, everybody said, you can't fire Gerard Mayo after 1 year. It's ridiculous. But he did anyway. And look, you know, the Patriots got to a Super Bowl when he first bought the team, largely on, you know, the back of Bill Parcells and his decisions. But then, you know, in 2000, he's got everybody in the world tell him, don't hire Belichick. He hires him. They win six Super Bowls. And everybody said, oh, my God, you're firing Gerard Mayo after 1 year. That's absolutely ridiculous. You can't do that. Well, he did it. And now they're in the Super Bowl again. So my whole thing, I think, about all this is that, you know, at some point you have to say, and whatever the reason is, and I don't know what the reason is, you have to just say at some point, okay, listen, I need to rethink my position on Robert Kraft, okay? For whatever reason, because I think Belichick did it all, or Brady did it all, or he didn't have anything to do with it, or I don't believe he really had a big hand in the 2011 labor negotiations. And in the week that his wife died, Jeff Saturday said he was the key to solving the roadblock that we had between players and owners late July 2011, so that no games were lost. And if you don't believe that he had nothing, had something tangible to do with all of the TV negotiations, or that he had a legitimate role in helping his team get to 10 Super Bowls, I can't help you. There's no reason then to put any owner in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. So the longer he stays out, the more I say, I hate to agree with conspiracy theorists, but the longer he stays out, the more I say, I find major fault with the voters about that. It's just, it's wrong.
There's one topic you and I discussed this years ago. I think I'd reached out to you because I was curious about your thoughts on Wes Welker at the time. And if he could string together a few more years, could he be considered a viable candidate for the Hall of Fame? And you made it clear back then, and I know that you still feel this way, that the wide receiver position is a very odd position. Statistically, you would think, there's a lot of guys who probably deserve consideration, but I know you have some strong feelings about that. This year's 15 candidate pool includes a first timer in Larry Fitzgerald and also Reggie Wayne and Torrey Holt. So can you just kind of dive into where you fall on how often and how many wide receivers are deserving of this honor?
Look, You know, my last few years on the committee, I think four times I was in the room for the discussion on Torrey Holt and Reggie Wayne. And look, I'm not, I would never argue that they were insignificant players. They were excellent players. And they both played big roles in their team. You know, first, obviously Reggie Wayne played a big role with Peyton Manning and Marvin Harrison. But, you know, I am not one of those people who think that players like Reggie Wayne and many players of this era, I'll say, I'm just not a believer that they are singular players. And I think to get into the Hall of Fame, you have to be a little bit more than somebody. I mean, Reggie Wayne caught over 1,000 balls. Torrey Holt caught over 900. They each obviously have a lot of touchdowns. But I can think of a lot of receivers in NFL history who didn't get drafted by the Indianapolis Colts. They got drafted by the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. And they had whoever throw into them and not Peyton Manning. And they didn't have Kurt Warner in his prime, you know, with the incredible years that he had. And again, I know that sounds like, oh, well, you're dissing Torrey Holt. You're dissing Reggie Wayne. I'm not. I just did not watch those teams a lot in those years and say what I see when I say, or say what I say when I watch Jackson Smith and Jigba, or when I watch Justin Jefferson, or when I watch Puka Nacua. Those guys, to me, are incredible football players who are going to be really, really good. Amon-Ra St. Brown, who I love watching all four of those guys. And I just don't, when I watched Reggie Wayne, I watched a guy who was a tremendous complimentary player and was a great asset for Peyton Manning. But if you ask me to name the amount of great catches and the amount of, you know, plays he made in the field that I just said, wow, look at that. Now that's an incredible receiver. I just didn't see that. Now, I've said this about everybody if I say I'm not going to vote for somebody. Okay, you got my opinion. Why don't you ask other people on the committee? If they're not getting in, there's a reason. And the reason is they're not getting enough votes. They're not getting enough votes because I think that a lot of people feel, probably the way I do, that they were really, really good players. But in my opinion, they belong in the Hall of Very Good.
That's interesting. Would you classify a guy like Larry Fitzgerald in the same kind of category?
Oh,
then?
No. Okay. Are you kidding me? Larry Fitzgerald caught 1,400 balls or whatever he caught. He was within a year and a half of catching or passing Jerry Rice. And he was healthy enough to do so, by the way.
Yeah.
Okay. But he came close. You know, he's the second leading wide receiver of all time. I mean, here's a guy who's got more than 300 catches more than any other wide receiver who ever played football other than Jerry Rice. You know, more than 300 more than Marvin Harrison, Chris Carter, Tim Brown, you know, Terrell Owens, all these guys. I mean, he just anyway. And also, look at the list of quarterbacks Larry Fitzgerald played with.
Bingo.
Just look at him. Yeah, he had Kurt Warner for a while. He had a lot more of the Max Halls of the world than Reggie Wayne had Peyton Manning. That's, you know, just look at the list of quarterbacks he played with. It's not good. And so I guess what I'm saying is Larry Fitzgerald, I mean, I don't know. I don't know who's getting in this year. I don't know what the story is. Larry Fitzgerald is the most deserving guy on that list. I mean, Drew Brees is too, but Larry Fitzgerald is the most deserving person on that list this year.
Yeah, and he's also one historic Santonio Holmes catch away from being a Super Bowl champion. You mentioned Brees and Fitzgerald. I think they're locks. I'm pretty sure they're getting in. Who else do you like? You don't have a vote this year, but if you did, who else would you choose among that group of 15?
Well, it's interesting that you asked that question because somebody asked me that a couple of weeks ago and said, who do you like? And I said, well, I'm probably not going to like the people who most people like, okay? Because, and again, it's an odd way to look at this, all right? But I think the way I look at it is I look for somebody who is absolutely special at his position. And the third guy on my list would be Adam Vinatieri. Because wow. Adam Vinatieri, in my opinion, if you look at the Patriots won all those Super Bowls by 3 points or 4 points, whatever, but they were all like, just nip and tuck games. And Vinatieri certainly was the difference. In the first one, he had a huge, obviously a huge game against the Raiders before that first game. So I just think he's the most clutch big game kicker that I ever covered, certainly. After that, Marshall Yanda would be next on my list. I think he was, interview J.J. Watt about Marshall Yanda. I mean, he had he was one of the most unnaturally strong guys, country strong guys to ever play pro football. And I think probably beyond that, I think Willie Anderson is really deserving without any question. But I think beyond that, it would be hard for me not to vote for Luke Kuechly. I think he was a tremendous player and very, very worthy of induction in Canton.
How about, I'm admittedly too young to know anything other than the 1981 Super Bowl that Kenny Anderson played in. Obviously a great year for him winning the MVP, but he was, an older player at that point. I did not see him in the 70s. When you look at Roger Craig, Kenny Anderson, Elsie Greenwood, who, again, virtually everybody on that Steel Curtain defense is in the Hall of Fame. I didn't get to see any of them other than highlights. Which of those guys do you think are worthy? If you operate, and this is not the smartest assumption, but if you do, play the odds and say that Kraft is going to get in, that only leaves two more spots. We know Belichick's out. That only leaves two more spots of those three senior candidates.
But the problem with saying it only leaves two more spots, you have to think of the math on this, which is, I think it would be a surprise almost any year if more than one guy gets in. Because I want you to think of this. There's 50 voters. Those 50 voters are handed a list of five people in the senior coaching or contributor category. A total of five. Okay, so there's three players. There's one contributor. And there's one coach. And you have the ability to vote for three of those five for election to the Pro Football Hall of Fame. So if you have the ability to vote for three, think about this. It takes 80% of the vote for somebody to get in. So you look around the room, 40 people have to vote for one of those five, for one of those five to get in. 40. So let's say, for instance, and I'm just going to guess, because I'm still really surprised about Belichick, but let's just say that Belichick got 38 votes, and I don't know what he got, but let's just say he got 38, just say for fun. That leaves 112 votes, all right? So now you have to ask yourself, there's four people left. All right. And so if you think two are going to get in, what you think is that two of those four are going to get at least 40. They're not going to get exactly 40. So let's say each one of them gets 43 or 44, right? So that means that those, you now have gotten 38 votes taken away from Belichick, by Belichick, and you've gotten 42 or 44 apiece. That's 88 more, 85, 88, 89 taken away by two more. So what it means is that you only have a handful of votes left. And I don't think that's the way it goes. I think you have a bunch of people in there who want to vote for Kenny Anderson. I think you have a bunch of people who want to vote for LC Greenwood. And probably my guess would be the most would want to vote for Roger Craig. That's just a guess because he had the 1,000, he, you know, caught for 1,000 and rushed for 1,000 yards. But again, look, so I'm not in there. I don't know. I didn't hear the discussion. Sometimes you can kind of feel momentum for a guy coming, but since I'm not there, I don't feel it. So I just don't know what happened. But I think what I would say overall is that just be careful with assuming anything with yeah. this Byzantine way of voting for seniors and coaches and contributors.
There is somebody who's not a finalist, and I'm very passionate about this because I think I cannot believe this guy is not a Hall of Famer. He hasn't coached in, I guess, you know, decade, 15 years, but his fingerprints are still all over the NFL. And that's Mike Shanahan, two-time Super Bowl champion. People who have coached under him have had incredible success as head coaches themselves, whether it was Sean McVay, his son Kyle, Matt LaFleur, Mike McDaniel most recently. Anthony Lynn played for him in Denver. We know about Gary Kubiak being a head coach. He has had such an influence in this league, not only on the field, but in terms of a mentor and really raising these young coaches to be highly successful head coaches in the league, yet he's not a finalist. I don't quite understand how Mike Shanahan is not a Hall of Famer. Where do you fall on that?
Well, I think Mike is the most, other than Belichick, I think Mike is the most deserving coach who's not in the Hall of Fame. There's a lot of reasons, but one of which is in whatever year it was, 1997, maybe 98, when Denver played the Packers in the Super Bowl, Packers were 11-point picks in that game. And in that week, or in the 2-week period, in that week, when the Broncos came in on either the Monday or Tuesday of that first week, Shanahan got them together and he goes, the Packers have the most impressive defensive line in football with Reggie White and Santana Dotson and Gilbert Brown. He's the best nose tackle in football. And, you know, they're going to be hell on wheels to block. It's going to be terrible or going to be hard. But that's not who I'm concerned with on the defense. I'm concerned with Leroy Butler because – if we stop Leroy Butler in this game, I will guarantee you we'll win the game. And I'm going to tell you why. So we went in to all the X's and O's about why Leroy Butler was the guy they had to stop. And in that Super Bowl, Shannon Sharpe was their best receiving weapon at that point, the tight end. And he basically told Shannon Sharpe, look, where you go, Leroy Butler is going to go. I do not want Leroy Butler in the middle of our running game, stopping our running game and being a roadblock for Terrell Davis. So I know you're not going to love this, but you're going to be split out wide all day and you're going to take Leroy Butler with you. And that's exactly what happened. Terrell Davis had whatever he had, well over 100 yards.
Yeah.
They won the game. They shocked the Packers. And I have always, whenever I've discussed coaches and that, it's always said in those meetings and in when we discuss things, well, you know, Mike Holmgren, he took two teams to the Super Bowl. He won with one and all that. Look, I love Mike Holmgren. Don't get me wrong. I shouldn't say I love Mike Holmgren, but I mean, I love him as a candidate, and I really, really like him as a person and a man and a coach, okay? But I really like his case. But let's be real. He was an 11-point favorite with a great team, one of the great teams of his day, that Packer team. 11-point favorite over the Denver Broncos. And in that game, Mike Shanahan out-coached him, out-strategized him, and he won. Won head-to-head. And those two guys are in competition now for one of the spots in the hall. But ask yourself this question. Shouldn't it matter a lot when the biggest game maybe of each of their careers comes against each other and Mike Holmgren's an 11-point favorite and Mike Shanahan makes a huge coaching decision in that game and the Denver Broncos win the game? Shouldn't that matter? Mike Holmgren, to me, with his two Super Bowl wins, even though, you know, he bombed out with the Raiders, he took the wrong job, and he bombed out with Washington because he worked for the worst owner in my 40 years of covering the NFL, and it's not even close, in Dan Snyder. So, you know, look, everybody's going to have an argument for their guy. There are going to be people who support Mike Holmgren and Mike Shanahan. I think they're both great candidates. People who support Tom Coughlin, great candidate. There's a lot of really good candidates. We won't even get into this, but, and then, so why in the world are we putting in, Tom Flores and Bill Cowher above all these guys? I don't, you're going to have to tell me that one. Not necessarily Cowher, but Tom Flores is to me, I just think that was a ridiculous pick over the guys we're talking about.
Yeah, I just think I agree with you on Flores. For Shanahan, it's just, you know, and I know that, I mean, maybe Alex Gibbs is a different conversation, but also intertwined. Just the zone blocking, running, the scheme, such an impactful part of football.
He's also got the best coaching tree in this century, and it's not even close. You realize either 22 or 20, I think 23, he had four coaches who at the end of the year, four head coaches in the league whose offenses were in the top 11 in the NFL. And, you know, so all of his stuff is still being done. Look, I'm a broken record on Shanahan. I just think it's ridiculous he's not in.
I mean, I could be wrong on this, but I think that the touchdown, the only touchdown that the Broncos had the other day from Stidham to Sutton, I could be wrong, but I thought it might have been sprint right option, which is a Mike Shanahan play.
Could be.
But yeah, I mean, just kind of ridiculous. Just to transition now to today's coaches and the openings, an inordinate number of openings. Typically you get, you know, 6, 7, maybe 8, 10 openings this year. As of this recording, only the Cardinals and the Raiders have yet to hire a head coach. 8 positions have been filled. I want to get your thoughts on what the biggest surprise was for you in terms of a coach getting let go. And who do you think is maybe not the best hire, but a hire that you think can potentially be a home run for one of these teams?
You know, I was surprised by Todd Monken in Cleveland because I not thinking that Todd Monken is not good. The Browns are so desperate right now to get an offensive coach to fix their quarterbacks. I mean, they're just desperate. And so I think that's probably why they picked him. I have always thought, I've been around Jim Schwartz a lot in my career, and I think that guy is really smart, and I think he's a leader of men. But again, I don't really know Todd Monken well at all. I might have talked to him once in my life, so I don't know. He might be fine, but that one surprised me. I was a little surprised that the Falcons jumped out for Kevin Stefanski. Not that I don't think Kevin Stefanski is any good, but I'll just say that, and I do mean this, I like Kevin Stefanski as a coach, but, you know, he's had a lot of resources and a lot of time to try to get the quarterback right in Cleveland, and he never did. And I'm not saying that it's his fault, okay? I'm just saying that he's an offensive guy. He never fixed the offense. So, you know, that is one of the reasons. Why did Brian Daboll get fired? He's an offensive guy who couldn't fix the offense and all that, whatever, consistently. So, you know, that kind of stuff always surprises me a little bit. But I think the one other thing that is notable, at least to me, I spent a day with the Broncos in mid-season for this book that I'm writing right now, and was really impressed. I was really impressed with Davis Webb. And I think it sounds like to me that if he doesn't get the Raiders job, if he doesn't get the Cardinals job, I have no idea who's getting what job. And I wouldn't take those jobs anyway. I don't care if Tom Brady is the president, the cook, the whatever. I don't care. I mean, the Raiders are where, you know, you know what the Raiders are. They're not good. But nor are the Cardinals. But if I were Davis Webb, I'd probably stay one more year at least with Sean Payton, run the offense, maybe even call the plays. And I'd stay one more year at least, because why would you want to cast your lot with one of those awful teams? And look, if I'm the Raiders, first of all, it looks like if I'm them, I'm in no hurry to hire anybody. I'm really not. Because, you know, first of all, the cream is gone. And now I might go into a second round of talking to all the people I haven't talked to yet. Okay. But the only reason I say that is that I think they have one big move left. I think they have the ability. And what I'd do if I were them is I'd trade Max Crosby. I looked at Tankathon recently. I don't have it in front of me, but so the Lions are maybe 17th in the first round, somewhere around there, 16, 17. Just trade Max Crosby for the 17th pick and maybe a fourth round pick, and just walk away and start rebuilding a bad team. You know, if you looked at the Raiders last year, at one point I looked at them, and half the guys starting on their defense were throwaways from veterans who were 29 years old or 27 years old on their third team trying to eke out another year or two. And I don't, look, a lot of these guys are still pretty good players, but you don't build for the future by signing Devin White, you know, for one or two more years. You know, they've got a good general manager in John Spytek. They need a bunch of draft capital. And that's what I'd do if I were them.
Yeah, it's fascinating that you mentioned that, because along those lines, you know, the Jets, who obviously have made their fair share of mistakes for a very long time, I thought did the smart thing with their new general manager, Darren Mooji, coming, who came from Denver, in trading Quinnen Williams, who I think is an exceptional player, and Sauce Gardner, who may not be as good as, you know, some of the accolades he's gotten. He turned those guys into three first-round picks for a team that was going nowhere with those two players. And he's doing exactly what you're suggesting the Raiders do by.
Well, I agree with you, and I don't think it's a bad strategy. But the one thing you have to do while you're on the road to doing that is you can't have a hopeless, hapless, ridiculous team. That's what the Jets were this year. And for some reason, you know, whatever the Jets touch turns to crap. And that is what has happened with them over the last few years. It's sad. You don't wish that on anybody, but you know, they bring in a coach who was one of the best defensive players in their recent history in Aaron Glenn, great guy, Parcells' disciple, got everything going for him. And was that season one of their biggest disasters ever? Yes, it was. And at the end of it, does he have any coaches left? Is he just standing there alone at the bow of the ship, just, you know, saying, hey, anybody want to come and work for us? This is a really bad situation. And so while I applaud them for saying, hey, let's look at the future and all that, I mean, you know, let's be honest. Really, let's be honest about all this. Okay. You know, you've got to do a better job holding the fort until the new stars come in, until you get fortified. You got to do a better job than what Aaron Glenn did this year. That was a debacle.
Yeah, it's funny. You know, Todd Bowles once told me when you know he didn't have some of the pieces earlier on, or actually after his first season, he always lived by the mantra: "You win with what you have until you get with what you want." And I agree with you. Look, they were non-competitive. That's probably a whole different podcast. But
I don't know anything about them. I just know that I'd watch them every week, and by halftime, they're behind 900-0. I mean, how in the world can you have any hope for the Jets? I don't care if they have 64 first round picks. I mean, come on. They're a laughing stock and have been for years. And I, you know, look, I'm not trying to jump on their grave, but holy crap, every decision they make turns to crap. It just does.
I want to talk about another team in the AFC East that moved on from their coach, and that's the Buffalo Bills. Were you surprised with Sean McDermott getting let go after that game in Denver? And how do you feel about the hire of Joe Brady?
You know, that's another one that a lot of times we can sit on the outside and say, oh, my God, they shouldn't have fired McDermott. And look, I do not think they should have fired Sean McDermott at all. Okay. And I understand that, you know, it's the old Einstein theory of, you know, doing the same thing every year and expecting different results. I get it. I understand that people are frustrated. But, you know, look, I remember a lot about the DeMar Hamlin year. Okay. The DeMar Hamlin month, let's say. And Sean McDermott was the surrogate father to about 20 guys on that team. He was utterly fantastic in that situation. He is the ultimate adult in the room. And the players, I don't care that they lost in Denver, those players still will walk through fire for that guy. I do not think he should have been fired. Now, having said that, I wasn't in, obviously none of us were in the room to hear Joe Brady's sales pitch. So I don't know. It's easy for me to say I wouldn't have fired him, but I, you know, who knows? Maybe Josh Allen, you know, gave Brandon Bean a look during the course of that and say, hey, this is my guy. Let's go. He can do it. We can do it. So, it's fine. I don't have a strong, Joe Brady's a good coach. I don't have a strong feeling one way or the other. I just don't think that you should have fired the guy you fired.
It just seems to me with a lot of the stuff that you were reading coming out from around there was that the fans, the media around there, they wanted to see change if they were going to move on from Sean McDermott. And by promoting from within, you're kind of getting the same that you had before, just with a different face. So yeah, for me, well, I was kind of
that's a good reason. That's a good reason why fans and talk show hosts should not hire coaches. So hey, that's all I can say. I mean,
hey, I was
we're not in the interviews. We don't hear what Joe Brady is saying. We don't know what Josh Allen says about Joe Brady. So I don't know, you know.
I was the guy sitting here saying keep Mayo after last year, and I was glad I'm glad I was not in the room for that. I'm glad I was not making decisions for that.
Oh, that's pretty funny. That's good.
There is one fascinating opening. It's not a head coaching opening, but it's what I thought on the surface looked like a very appealing job, and that's the offensive coordinator for the Philadelphia Eagles. Two Super Bowls out of the last four, reigning Super Bowl champs for another week or so, yet they are now in what, week two of their OC search process. A couple years ago, when they moved on from Brian Johnson, it took them 4 days to hire Kellen Moore, and Kellen Moore ultimately helped them land a Super Bowl. Now it seems like they can't find the guy that they want, or the guys they want don't want them. And there's, you know, a lot of discussion in Philadelphia about whether that's because of the power structure in which Howie Roseman and Jeffrey Lurie have a lot of say. There's a sentiment that maybe an offensive coordinator would not want to adapt Nick Sirianni's principles because he's an offensive-minded coach who doesn't call plays. And then I think the most fascinating element to all this, Peter, is do these coveted candidates want to coach Jalen Hurts? And that's a funny thing to say because he is a Super Bowl MVP. But at the same time, I think it's a fair question when you look at Brian Daboll, for example, choosing to work with Cam Ward in Tennessee over Jalen Hurts. Mike McDaniel choosing to work with an uber-talented player in Justin Herbert in Los Angeles instead of Jalen Hurts. Where do you fall on how appealing this offensive coordinator position in Philadelphia is? And do you think that it's possible that Jalen Hurts could be a detriment to luring in somebody who's really good?
It seems impossible for me to think of, because, you know, I think of Jalen Hurts, and I think I've had four interviews with Jalen Hurts in my life. And the last time I saw him was and had a conversation with him was in training camp, actually, of 23. Now, I take that back. One of my last, because I did talk to him at some length in the playoffs that year. But I'll never forget. I was going around. I was on my training camp tour, and everybody, I was taking portraits of everybody in training camp that I was going to use in my column, you know, just very tight face shots. I'm in my office now in my house in Brooklyn, and I'm looking in my apartment in Brooklyn, and I'm looking over at the Tua Tagovailoa portrait where he's doing the what's that, the Hawaiian thing with the hands. I don't know, but anyway, I did that with everybody. And so I get to Philadelphia, and I said, hey, everybody I interview, I'm taking a portrait of. And he goes, okay. He said, wait a minute. Give me your camera. Give me your phone. And he took a selfie of me and him. And he had this big, broad smile on his thing. And I don't know why he did it, but he just started laughing. He handed it to me, and he goes, this is a lot better. And that was it. But I think one of the reasons why I'm kind of I have taken to him is because I think Jalen Hurts is one of these guys who, you know, he's like Phil Sims. I used to say this about Phil, that when I covered the Giants, Phil truly, a lot of people say this, but Phil truly wouldn't care if he threw for 10 yards or 510. If they win the game, that's the only thing that ever mattered to him. And Jalen Hurts is like that. He just doesn't care. He's a coach's kid. Every time I talk to him, there was never anything, look what I did. It was always a deflection and team. And, you know, one time Nick Sirianni told me that it was 9 o'clock on a Monday night, at their facility, and there was Jalen in there studying or watching tape. And he said, get the hell out of here. Go home. You know? And so Jalen Hurts is committed. He wants it. I just think, and I've never met Kevin Petullo in my life. But I do think that a lot of what they've done in the last few years, and now you guys are going to tell me if I'm right or I'm wrong. Okay. But I think that this will be the fifth consecutive year that they've started with a new offensive coordinator. And, you know, I just have one two-word sentence to say to Nick Sirianni and to Howie Roseman. Stop it. Stop. Stop doing this to your offense. Stop doing it to your quarterback. You know, and so, and again, you know, obviously they don't hire Kevin Petullo thinking that midway through his first year, people are going to egg his house. You know, they don't think that. But, you know, this decision, the more I've thought about it, because Manish, you and I talked earlier today, the more I thought about it, the more I say, what a vital hire this is for Nick Sirianni. Because you've just simply got to stop with this temp job offensive coordinator thing with the Eagles.
Do you think, though, that, look, Hurts is in whatever, year 6, 5, 6, whatever it may be, and once you get to that stage, I'm not saying you can't grow. Obviously, you can grow as a 30-plus-year-old quarterback, but do you think that some of the candidates are thinking – it might be a little bit harder to, I don't want to say break bad habits, but reach another level with him versus a guy like Cam Ward, former number one pick, only 1 year of experience. He's moldable, for lack of a better phrase.
Well, Brian Daboll, I couldn't agree with you more. Brian Daboll took the Tennessee job, and who knows? I would assume that he could have had the Philadelphia job if he wanted it. But I think... you know, I think one thing about going to work in a quieter environment with a young quarterback, you know, look, I kind of look at Sam Darnold right now. Half of me says, oh, my God, everybody should have seen that coming. Come on. Why couldn't you see that when he was coming out of USC? But this is, after all, year 8 for Sam Darnold. So everybody can say, see, I told you, I loved Sam Darnold back in the day. Well, you know, he ended year 7 looking like an abject disaster. And, you know, so anybody who says, see, I told you, I always loved Sam Darnold. Yeah, right, right. Why don't you tell us about the time that, why don't you tell us about Sam Darnold? Tell us about the time you had the 7 lotto numbers correct, you know, and you were going to win $16 billion. Oh, but I just got one number wrong. You know, come on, come on. Nobody.
I mean, Peter, I will say, like, I will say, in my, I was completely biased. I always thought Sam Darnold was going to be great. Now, I saw him from day one, and
Here's the thing. If I said to you 2 years ago, hey, remember, you're the one who said 5 years ago that Sam Darnold was going to be great when he couldn't get off the bench in Carolina or San Francisco in consecutive years. What would you have said then? Would you have said, oh, no, no, you're wrong. I guarantee you that he's going to go to a team or he's going to find a place and he's going to be an all pro. No, you wouldn't have said that. You would have said, eh, I guess I blew that one.
It wouldn't be the first time.
It would have.
It definitely would not have been the first time that I blew a prediction. And speaking of Sam Darnold, Super Bowl 60 coming up, a really intriguing matchup between great defense and underrated defense and two interesting quarterbacks. I mean, you touched on Darnold, a great redemption story without a doubt. Before we get into a couple specifics of the game, I do want to circle back to championship weekend. And I want to ask you, I mean, you have covered the league for almost as long as I've been alive. Why do you think in this day and age that head coaches, smart head coaches, future Hall of Fame head coaches are seemingly allergic to field goals. I mean, it obviously came back to bite Sean Payton and the Broncos not going for a chip shot field goal, but you see it over and over, whether it's Ben Johnson, Campbell, all across the league. It's almost as if they completely discount taking the points, where for so long in NFL history, it was a no-brainer to take the points.
Because every team now has summa cum laude people in the analytics department, and they have figured things out. And I'm not mocking them. I love analytics people, truly. I think they're really smart. And they question everything, which is fine with me. I would be shocked, not surprised. I'd be shocked if the Denver Broncos, you know, analytics people supported Sean Payton doing what he did on Sunday with a quarterback who hasn't played in 2 years against a defensive front that is a top three or four defensive front in football. And I'd just be shocked whether they were going to run or whether they were going to pass. If a guy would have said, hey, by the way, got some snow in the forecast after halftime, I think it'd be a good idea to take a 2-score lead right now. You have no idea if this guy is going to piss a drop the rest of the game. You just don't know. So maybe, and I believe right now, truly believe that Sean Payton totally regrets the decision, should regret the decision, obviously, and understands that this sometimes you simply just have to take the points. And I mean, I've heard everybody talk about it. We all sound like total, absolute Neanderthals. Take the points, take the points, blah, 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 blah. But even the really, really smart young people in the game who are coaching right now. And I don't mean to try to make this a, I don't mean to put every smart guy in this category right now, or every young guy into the smart guy category. But you saw with Liam Cohen, who's had a great year. You saw him in the wild card game against Buffalo early on, 4th and 2 against the Bills. You know, going for the going for the touchdown rather than going for the field goal. You've seen every coach, all the smart coaches, young coaches, brilliant coaches. Everybody is doing it. And I think this offseason, you know, there has to be a recalibration. You have to just ask yourself, listen, tell me if, because the one thing I kept saying when I was watching that, the Denver game, I said, even if he gets 4 feet here on this play and converts the first down, that's not a guarantee he's going to score a touchdown. Not even close to a guarantee. He's still got to get either another first down or whatever. And, you know, anyway, I think that there's going to be a recalibration this offseason.
Are you surprised along those lines in that game? I thought it was great. You're watching it on TV when the field is blanketed with snow. I mean, NFL history is littered with tremendous games in that type of weather. But there seemed to be an uproar about how it wasn't competitive because the teams couldn't do much in that weather. I know that in Philadelphia, for example, there's discussion about potentially having a dome stadium in Philadelphia, which I think would be ridiculous. I mean, one of the highlights of the Super Bowl season last year was that snow game and the divisional round between the Eagles and the Rams. Where do you fall on when the conditions are that rough? It's not an enjoyable product.
I enjoyed it. I mean, I read Mike Florio's. I love Mike. I'm good friends with Mike. I think it's utterly preposterous. I think, you know, saying that you ought to put games in a neutral site if there's weather or what. I don't even know what the full argument is. Look, you know, I once saw Michael Vick beat Brett Favre in a snowstorm at Lambeau Field when Vick was 23 years old. I mean, the highlight, if you ask Michael Vick right now, what's the highlight of your NFL career? He'd say, beating Brett Favre in a snowstorm in the playoffs at Lambeau. Are you kidding me? And yeah, what could be bigger than that other than winning a Super Bowl, you know? But football was made to be played in all conditions. That's just the way it is. I thought it was ridiculous, but the strategy was really cool. How about when Josh McDaniels and Drake May, you know, they've talked about it. Unless your guy is absolutely, totally wide open, throw the ball in the first row of the bleachers. I mean, you know, I mean, there is something about that, that you're not trying to be pretty. You're just trying to get the clock down to double zero. That's it. Good for them. It happened that way. I don't think it was miserable. I don't think it was a waste of time. I thought the strategy was good. And did anybody say that, by the way, when Adam Vinatieri made a miracle field goal in Foxborough, you know, that helped propel the Patriots in the middle of a blizzard to go to the Super Bowl that year? I mean, that's one of the great kicks in NFL history. How would you have felt if, what was it, 48 yards? I don't even remember, 45. I don't even remember what it was. But would you have preferred that, oh, wait a minute, we got snow coming this weekend. Let's move the game to the RCA Dome in Indianapolis. Let's move it so that we can have a real football game. F that.
F that.
Ridiculous. Play football in weather. It's fun.
I personally would love to see a Super Bowl played in weather. I know that will never, ever happen. But
it's not going to happen. You can't ask people to pay seven. Look, they got lucky. They got really lucky in the Meadowlands.
Yes, they did.
Really lucky. It was the warmest day in January or February history. And, you know, I remember going to the game that day. I was on the media bus going over. And I said, hey, after this game, Mets and Yankees are playing a night game at Citi Field. It's going to be 64 degrees out there. I mean, it was ridiculous. You know, but I'm not a big fan of seeing an outlier thing happen and say, well, that's it. You can never do that again. You know, just play football in weather.
It speaks to the testament of the coaching staff when you have to add that element into it. And like, I'm just like you. I love snow games. I think it's the most enjoyable thing to watch. But this Super Bowl obviously is being played in California, so we won't have any snow to contend with. I just wanted to get your thoughts on this matchup and how my New England Patriots and Drake May, the kind of the Cinderella story of this season, face off against that significantly talented Seattle Seahawks team, a team that I slept on majority of the year. Manish was on it right away. So I want to get your thoughts on that.
24 years ago, the Patriots entered a Super Bowl with less than zero chance to beat the greatest show on turf in a dome. And they figured out a way. This year, it's not nearly the same line. I don't even know what the line is, but they're not nearly as big an underdog, but they're underdogs and deservedly so. The Seahawks are playing out of their minds. But this is the exact same Patriots team. You know, they just need, you know, Tom Brady to complete a few passes to J.R. Redman inside the 2-minute warning. Yes. And they need John Madden up in the booth to say, oh, no, they're just going to go for the field goal and they're going for overtime. You know, that's what the Patriots need. That would be good karma for them in this game. Bring John Madden back. But, you know, they're an underdog team. Nobody knows who they are. And, you know, instead of Otis Smith and Ty Law being the men right now. Now it's, you know, Milton Williams and Robert Spillane and, you know, maybe Christian Gonzalez. But, I mean, they got a bunch of good, young, unknown – well, Spillane's not that young – but a bunch of good, young, unknown defensive players who are going to determine whether they have a chance in this game or not.
It's interesting, too. The Patriots 9-0 on the road this year. You know, I personally love the theatrics of Mac Hollins going into the locker room, kind of showing this team's identity going into this game. And I think they're just going to channel that and really put up a real fight against the Seahawks team. I'm personally nervous because I think Seattle's defense has been incredible.
We should be nervous because, I mean, look, here are the facts. They played an easier schedule than the Temple Owls played this year. Okay. They had an easier playoff run than Ferris State in Division II. Okay. Because of, you know, obviously that, you know, the Chargers were wounded. CJ Stroud played a game like somebody handed him the football before the game and he said, "What is this?" And then, you know, the obviously in the championship game, I mean, they got one of the biggest breaks any team's ever gotten heading into a championship game. You're playing a quarterback who has not stepped on the field in 2 years. You know, so the Patriots have gotten every break on God's green earth coming into the Super Bowl. However, A, who cares? B, it doesn't mean anything. What do you want them to do? It's not their fault. And C, Mike Vrabel and Josh McDaniels are going to understand how to play this game. And by that, I mean, they're going to understand, you know, it could be that Drake May is going to throw 43 passes in this game. It could be that he'll throw 16, you know. They're going to figure out what gives them the best chance. I have huge confidence in both of those guys.
And I think, too, the fact that they, you know, I'll push back a little bit on the easy path. Like, I get the offensive side of it.
But no,
like, you get some top defenses.
You can't. Stop. Oh, stop it. Stop. Just stop. If you want to push back, go ahead. But you're going to be wrong.
Manisha's been telling me that for weeks, and I've been pushing back. But the defenses they've played have been legit. And obviously in the first two games,
how have the offenses been that they played? How about those Dolphins?
I'm talking specifically about the playoffs when we're talking about the Broncos defense, the Chargers defense, and the Texans defense.
Yeah, but the Broncos defense, you know, the Broncos defense kicked the living crap out of them. I mean, and it was a bad weather day. So how can you tell anything about that? They scored a touchdown on a gigantic break by a quarterback who got nervous in the biggest moment of the game. And he made a huge mistake. He handed the ball to the Patriots, and they scored on a drive that I believe covered 11 inches. So, I mean, you know, so don't
They didn't turn the ball over. They didn't turn the ball over.
Don't tell me how tough it's been for the Patriots. Stop.
Defensively, it's been tough, but they haven't looked great through it. So I will give you that. I think they're prepared to face another really, really good defense in this Super Bowl.
Look, you know, the great thing about them is that I think they have a quarterback who's not going to be afraid, he really has not played very well in the postseason.
No, he hasn't.
But, you know, when you play three games in the postseason, the three biggest games of the year, and you survive even though you've turned it over more than you've thrown touchdowns, that's good fortune right there. And so, you know, he's going to have to play better because Sam Darnold looks like he's going to be pretty good, or mm-hmm. at least in position to be pretty good. And they got one of the best receivers holy crap, that Jaxon Smith-Njigba.
Unbelievable.
He is so good. So, you know, hey, look, but like I say, if in how many ever days from now, if they're holding, if the Patriots are holding the Super Bowl trophy, I'm not going to say I told you so, but I am going to say I am not surprised by one iota, because they're a smart team, smart coaches, and players who can execute very well. So they absolutely, unequivocally have a good chance to win this game.
Are you picking them, Peter?
No, but but I'm not. I wouldn't be surprised. It just reminds me of 24 years ago. It just really does. But you know, we'll see.
Peter, you've always been the hardest working man in this industry, and even in retirement, you have a piece that will be airing on NBC during the Super Bowl Sunday pregame show. Can you share a little bit about what that's about?
I'm doing. I did a story this fall. I proposed a story after last Super Bowl when I actually saw Tom Rinaldi's story that Brad Pitt voiced in the Super Bowl about the huddle. And I thought it was really cool that you do something a little thoughtful in the Super Bowl pregame show is 3 days long. So you should at some point, instead of having Al Roker cook tacos in the parking lot at Levi's Stadium. It's, you know, you should have some time to do something that's a little bit thoughtful. And I just went around the country to five hinterlands places and said, what does football still mean to this country? And I went to a girls' flag game in the middle of Alabama. And you know what I did, Manish? I went to see Williams College play, and I highlighted Luke Mangini, and I watched the game with Eric Mangini.
Oh, that's awesome.
Luke is a sophomore linebacker, and my favorite factoid about this entire trip is that, you know, I went there on finals week, and Luke Mangini, I can't even pronounce a couple of the finals or the midterm week. Excuse me. It was midterm week. I can't even pronounce some of the things, but Luke Mangini is like determined to be fluent in Japanese. He's just,
that's awesome.
He is this. First of all, he's a football nerd, but he's also an academic nerd. And I came away with a lot of respect for him and a lot of respect for his parents. He was really raised well. But anyway, went around the country, saw a lot of cool scenes, went to a Native American reservation in Nebraska, went to a high school game in Alaska. So I just had a good experience. It'll be a cool piece. It'll be about 5 minutes long during the pregame show. So I hope a few people get to see it and enjoy it.
That's great. Did you think of those destinations? How did you come up with these places?
I wanted to go far and wide, but I had a producer named Dave Wilkie, a Jersey guy. And Dave did a fabulous job on this. He helped pick out some of the places. And so we kind of combined on the places we should go. Originally, there's a high school that plays in Hawaii, and their field is quite literally right, you know, 30 yards from the Pacific Ocean. And I wanted to do a game there because I thought it'd be the craziest visual of all time. But we went to Alaska instead and saw a game in a driving rainstorm, which was not quite as fun maybe, but it was real. And I enjoyed it a lot. I enjoyed seeing a lot of kids who, man, high school football and small college football is so much fun and is so valuable to these kids. So I enjoyed that a lot.
That sounds like an incredible experience.
Yeah.
Peter, you're also finishing up a book. Can you tell us a little bit about what it is and when do you think that it will be available
for us? As we record this, I got 3 chapters to go and a little more than 2 weeks to finish them. So you've just taken an hour and a half out of my life, and I hate you.
I apologize. I'm sorry.
But if I didn't have such a big mouth, we would have been done a half hour ago. But I decided after I retired and I was sitting around for a while, I just decided that, look, I don't want to stay up till 4 o'clock in the morning anymore on Sunday night, but I do want to have something to do. And so I decided to go back and write a book about my 40 years covering the NFL. And each year is a chapter. 1984, my year covering the Bengals in Cincinnati, my first year. 1985, I revisit my interview with Pete Rozelle. Like, I go back and I interview people who were involved in the story. The strike year in 1987, they played replacement games. Interviewed Chicago Bears replacement quarterback Sean Payton. Just every year I went back and I retell the story with new, and in some cases, a lot of sort of, what can I say? A lot of details that are just going to really surprise you, I think. But it was so much fun. And although I wrote it for a publisher, I really wrote it for myself because I wanted to go back and revisit, John Randall, 1998. He became the highest paid player in football. And I went to Texas where he took me back to the home he was raised in, a corrugated metal shack, about 400 square feet, where he lived with his mom and 2 brothers for 8 or 9 years. And I can't believe, it would have been hard to think of his pets living in there, quite honestly. No bathroom, no anything, not even an outhouse. At one point I see the tears coming down his cheek. And listen, Manish, I have been blessed beyond belief to be able to do what I've done for a living. I'm grateful. And I just really, with this book, I want to take people on this ride with me. I want to take them on the bus with me and John Madden. I want to take them into the room with Paul Tagliabue when he starts crying after 9/11. I want to take them into the night that I'm sitting there with Carson Palmer in his house in Paradise Valley, Arizona, and the game plan from the Cardinals comes through, and he works for the next 4 hours in pencil with a mechanical pencil, drawing every diagram himself, even though he doesn't have to draw them. That's how he learns. And I just, I saw and I experienced a lot of things, and hopefully in revisiting those and in re-reporting those, you'll learn a lot about football and enjoy the stories.
I cannot wait. I mean, I've read, I would say, probably 100% of the stories that you're going to revisit. Did you have a working title for the book?
It's called The Game. And it'll be out in late October. So it's going to be fun, at least for me. And I hate to say it, I was very selfish in this. If I didn't want to write about something, I didn't. And if I wanted to write about something, I did. And I never really asked for permission from the editor, from the publisher, from my agent, from anything. I said, here's what I want to do. They said, good, go. It's been a great, great partnership. So anyway, it's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, I would say the one word that comes to mind first when I think of you is selfless, not selfish, but your track record as a reporter speaks for itself. Again, the best reporter of my lifetime, somebody I admired growing up, got the privilege to get to know in this business. One of the most influential people in this industry. We talked about Mike Shanahan and the influence and impact he had on younger coaches. I think the same thing could be said about Peter King and reporters of both genders, all races, all ages, just an incredibly thoughtful and giving person. And I'm not only happy that we had the time to talk tonight, but I have been very happy over the last 15 years getting to know you. And I'm so happy that you have an opportunity now to kind of go at whatever pace you want to go at. I know that you and your wife are going to the Olympics. I hope you enjoy that immensely. And again, I cannot wait for this book. I cannot wait for what is next for you in quote unquote retirement, because whatever you touch turns to gold. And I'm really thankful that you gave us the opportunity to share some of your thoughts on some of the goings on of the NFL in the past and today.
Hey, Manish, thanks a lot. It was great to be on with you both, and appreciate it. And I'm sure we'll be in touch. And I'm holding you to your promise to buy a copy.
I will. I am not one of those guys who asked for the free copy. I understand it's a business. I may get multiple copies for my friends, but I promise you that I will be paying for whatever I read.
Hey, great being with you guys. Take care, huh?
Thanks, absolutely. Peter, just real quick, I can't top what Manish said. I've been following you for so long, part of my NFL fandom. I can't tell you how much I appreciate you taking the time to sit down and talk with us about all this stuff. So, again, thanks again.
A lot of fun. Thank you, guys.
All right. That's been another episode of Between the Tackles. We'll catch you next week.